I would have had the announcement I'm about to make in the bulletin, except that our financial secretary, Clint Hufford, and our church secretary, Mary, read the bulletin before it gets printed, and they would have tried to stop me. So I have to do this from the pulpit. Billy and I have asked that the flowers on the communion table this morning be in honor of Clint and Mary Hufford, whose extraordinary dedication to this church has made our work so delightful. I have been associated with Mary in two churches for over 20 years, and I cannot even imagine anyone more cooperative, more accurate in record keeping and paperwork, or more courteous and friendly to people who come into the church office during the week. Clint became part of our church life about 9 years ago, and anyone who watches him knows that he gives us 125% all the time. Clint and Mary do not count the hours they work. They often have to continue their chores at home, but you never hear about it because they do not advertise the extent of their loyalty to this place. As a kind of husband-wife ministry team in this blessed church, Billy and I know better than anyone else how fortunate our lives have been because of these two people. They won't care for this either, but if Clint and Mary would stand for a moment. Where are they? Are they here? Is Clint hiding, Mary? Okay. He's hiding. I should have known he might escape. There he is. Oh, I think he probably was back there counting your money. Working all the time. Nothing better describes the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, where we have been living for so many weeks, than the title of a song popular some years ago, "Love is a Many Splendored Thing." Each week, we have turned toward the light a new facet of what Paul called agape, the kind of love he thought would make the world radically different if it were practiced. One facet of that love, the one I would like to illuminate this morning, is its remarkable power to endure, to last, to hang on through the most difficult and unrewarding times, the kind you and I have on occasion. Before we hear Paul's specific comment, let's think for a moment about stamina. If you look back to the New Testament for a definition of it, you find it easily in the life of a fisherman whose name was Peter. One night, unexpectedly freed from the prison into which Herod had put him, he knocked at the door of John Mark's house, where his friends had gathered to wonder where he was and what had happened to him. When the maid heard his voice, she was so excited and happy, she forgot to open the gate and instead ran back to tell the others. In the meantime, Peter went right on knocking. It's an odd little detail to include in the New Testament, in this book about the meaning of life. Do we really care about some man's knocking at the door? But it adds a touch of real life, and it does symbolize, in a way, how Peter lived his life. As a fisherman, he kept on fishing, even when he had toiled all night and caught nothing. As a disciple, He kept on following, even after he had fallen flat on his moral backside again and again. The thing we always say about Peter is that he was impetuous, always first on the scene, always first to open his mouth, even if only to put his foot into it. But it was another quality, sheer, dogged persistence, that made him the second most memorable character in the early church. People who simply endure change the world more than we imagine. One of the staples of my fourth grade education was the story of how Thomas Edison struggled to invent the incandescent light bulb. The idea struck like lightning, but the fulfillment came only after tedious months of plodding, persistent, and often discouraging hard work. Edison certainly earned the right to make his famous definition of genius as 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. There are dozens of people with great ideas and splendid starts for every one with staying power. People who make a spectacular plunge into the ocean of some great venture while the crowd cheers, but who, by the time the spray falls back and the sea is still, are nowhere to be found. They had the incentive to start, but not the stamina to keep going. I hope somebody remembers Dag Hammarskjöld, one of the most remarkable men ever to be associated with the United Nations, Nobel Peace Prize winner. I have liked many things this gifted man said, and particularly this: when the morning's freshness has been replaced by the weariness of midday, when the leg muscles quiver under the strain, the climb seems endless, and suddenly nothing will go quite as you wish, it is then that you must not hesitate. He practiced that. Someone asked Jim Corbett, who at the time was the heavyweight boxing champion, what he thought was the most important thing a man had to do to reach that level in boxing. He had a simple, classic answer: fight one more round. The truth of human life, I know, is more complex than some catchy challenge like that, but there is truth in that one. I remember that the Duke of Wellington said the British soldiers at Waterloo were no braver than Napoleon's men, but they were braver for 5 minutes more. Now, the reason for saying these mundane things about stamina is that we have come this morning to that moment in 1 Corinthians 13 where Paul says that love has the most remarkable capacity for sticking with it even when it makes no more sense to others. Love, he says, knows no limit to its endurance. I think it's this very quality that has written the most shining chapters in the history of what love has meant to humankind. We can outthink, out-argue, outwit, and outfight others, and yet fail utterly to win them in the only way that means anything. And that way, which Christ proclaimed in the face of much satirical laughter and contempt, is the way of sacrificial love. Where did we get it? Where in the long evolution of humankind does it come from? It's hard to imagine how it could have developed through a process like the survival of the fittest, those who are fittest to survive are not going to be the ones most inclined to love. Christ strikes me as a test case for that. He didn't survive. He wasn't the fittest. The birds of the human flock pecked him to death. And yet, in a way that the indifferent world of nature cannot comprehend, he does survive. Something totally different from the automatic and mechanical process of the survival of the fittest came into play. It was the power of a particular human attribute called love. Christianity declares that God is love, and frankly, it is for that reason that I profess the faith I do. There is plenty of darkness in this world, and insoluble mystery in my own chosen religion, much that I can never hope to understand. But there is one central and luminous point of absolute certainty. That is the power of love, and that is enough. To go on loving beyond all hope of a fair return, to refuse to quit in the face of any odds, to endure until victory comes, if it takes a lifetime, this is the quality of agape love. A love that reminds me of the millenniums of wind and water that slowly but inexorably wore down the limestone and granite to make the Grand Canyon of the Colorado. We have, I am sorry to say, by careless use of language and weakness of will, degraded the phrase Christian love, made it something so soft and sentimental that people snicker at it, and there is no worse thing that could happen to the religion of Christ. The love he taught and practiced is beyond question the most powerful energy on earth. In the end, calling out for God, mumbling, "Father, forgive them," his love endures. And as that most gifted preacher of modern times, Fred Buechner, has said, in a way, his words are a love song, the greatest love song of them all. "Father, forgive them." This kind of love has to endure the worst and still be true to itself. It has to sustain the most shattering defeats and still be love. There is no power like the power of a love that suffers to the utmost, is battered, bruised, spat upon, crucified, and yet remains love. In the end, the human heart cannot withstand the power of love like that. Even those who reject it are finally broken and captured. This is the theme of what many people consider the most poignant and haunting parable Jesus ever told, the story of the prodigal son, who, like most of us, misunderstood the nature of love in two ways before its unwillingness to give up brought him back to life. A poet whose name would probably mean very little to anyone put it this way in a free verse poem about the prodigal son. He came back from the gray dust of alien streets and the smell of the swine coat, back to love. Two things he would never understand: why he had fled love, for the dark streets and the black wine? Or why, when he quit the swinecote, love ran to meet him on the road? But he did not need to understand. It was enough that music from the house washed over him, and that he was kissed, and that the words fell on his spirit, "This my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." If you have ever heard a mother or father say this after years of hopelessness, you know what music those words make. "This my daughter was lost and is found." It is the archetypal human experience. And many sons and daughters, and some husbands and wives, know what it means to be found by a love that has waited and believed all through the absent years. In a way, the parable is only a dramatization of Christ's own life. Remember this verse? "Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end." The last three words define the extraordinary love of Christ. Most of us can love for a while, or sporadically, especially when people are responsive. But to love on when they are ungrateful, indolent, and uncaring, this calls for more power than we possess, and without it, we often turn cynical. Please forgive me for the constant reminders that this love we are talking about is not what we usually mean, that it has nothing to do with infatuation or feelings, nothing to do with greeting cards and a dozen red roses. I would love to think that someone remembers the three-word definition I provided last week for the word agape, which Paul uses, and which we translate as love in English. Paul is talking about undiscourageable goodwill. Let me show you what that would be in action. Back in 1927, a real estate development firm in Savannah, Georgia, failed, and the investors lost $300,000, a great deal of money in 1927. The man who founded the firm, along with his son, vowed to pay back each investor. But you know what happened 2 years later, in 1929. The stock market crashed, and the president of the firm could not make good on his promise. His Christian faith had taught him about agape love, undiscourageable goodwill, and his inability to do the right thing for people who had trusted him weighed so heavily on his mind that some thought it hastened his death. After he died, his son, imbued with the same notions, kept assuring investors that he would make good on the obligation. In 1957, 35 years later, the son deposited in a Savannah bank over $1 million, and every investor or an heir was paid back the original investment plus interest. Was he a fool, or someone living on the next level? There are a few people in every century whose love outlasts any kind of logic. Lit by some divine fire, it refuses to go out. And because we have seen it in these few, we know it's possible. Paul Tillich, in one of his books, tells the true story of a woman whose life was a classic example of enduring, indomitable love. Her name was Elsa Brandstrom, the daughter of a former Swedish ambassador to Russia, but hundreds of thousands of prisoners of war knew her only as the Angel of Siberia. She was an irrefutable, living witness to the truth that love is the ultimate power of being, even in a century which surely belongs to the darkest, most destructive, and cruel of all centuries since the dawn of our history. At the start of the First World War, when Elsa was 24, she looked out of the window of the Swedish embassy in what was then St. Petersburg, before it became Leningrad and then came back to being St. Petersburg again, looked out the window and saw German prisoners of war being driven through the streets on their way to Siberia. From that moment, she could no longer tolerate the splendor of the diplomatic life of which until then she had been a greatly complimented and beautiful part. She became a nurse and began visiting the prison camps. She saw unspeakable things and began almost alone her fight against cruelty, and she prevailed. She fought the resistance and suspicion of the authorities, and she prevailed. She had to fight the brutality of the prison guards, the cold, hunger, dirt, and illness of an undeveloped country in a bitter war, and she prevailed. Love gave her wisdom with innocence and the stamina to survive 100 setbacks. She visited the hungry and gave them food. She saw the thirsty and gave them drink. She welcomed the strangers, clothed the naked, strengthened the sick. She herself fell ill and was imprisoned, but the irresistible power of love burned in her like a strange fire which no circumstance could quench. After the war, she began working for the orphans of German and Russian prisoners of war. The sight of her among those children was their greatest single religious experience for many people. With the coming of the Nazis, she and her husband were forced out of Germany and came to America, where she at once became the helper of innumerable European refugees. Quote, "For 10 years, Paul Tillich writes, I was able personally to observe the creative genius of her love. We never had a theological conversation. It was unnecessary. She made God transparent in every moment. For God, who is love, was abiding in her and she in him. On her deathbed, she received a delegate from the kings and people of Sweden, representing uncounted multitudes all over Europe, assuring her that she would never be forgotten by those to whom she had given back the meaning of their lives. It is a rare gift to meet a human being in whom love is so overwhelmingly manifest. Where is God? Almost every human being asks at some time or other, in one way or other, and here is the only real answer. It's an answer that undercuts all theological arrogance that tries to imprison God in some sectarian creed or in some particular church. It is more than justice, and it is greater than faith and hope. In my favorite translation of the verse in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says it like this: love can outlast anything. It is, in fact, the one thing that still stands when all else has fallen. It is the presence of God Himself, because God is love. And in every moment of genuine love, we dwell in Him and He in us. The rest is trivial.